The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Well, as we all know by now, Roe v. Wade has been overturned. Many of us still marvel that it happened in our lifetimes. It does change things, but it does also present for us significant challenges. Well, just in time for the Supreme Court's official overruling of Roe v. Wade, pro-life scholar Ryan T. Anderson and pro-life journalist Alexandra DeSanctis released the ultimate guide, and I use that word deliberately, the ultimate guide to the pro-life policy issue, titled Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. It is captivating. It reframes the ongoing debate in the current climate with the truth and this nearly 50 years experiment with unlimited abortion in America has harmed everyone, even its most passionate proponents. Tearing Us Apart is a comprehensive guide. It's made for everyone because the Supreme Court decision affected everyone. All of our lives. Ryan T. Anderson is a PhD, the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment, and Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. He's a graduate of Princeton and Notre Dame. He is the St. John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas. He lives on a small family farm in Virginia with his wife and their three children. Alexandra DeSanctis is visiting fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, is a staff writer at National Review, and is widely published journalist covering politics, abortion, the pro-life movement, elections, and religion. She, too, is a graduate of Notre Dame and a former William F. Buckley Jr. Fellow in political journalism at the National Review Institute. She lives in Northern Virginia with her husband, and we are delighted to have both of you with us today. Welcome.
Great to be with
Thanks
you.
For having us.
This is such a significant moment because while Roe v. Wade has been overturned and the decision making on the subject of abortion has been returned to the people, the nation is grappling with how to move forward. And for many pro-lifers in particular, the challenge for us is to rethink the direction that we ought to go. Let's begin, as you do in the book, talking about the major harm that abortion produces. You might assume, your first chapter is titled Abortion Harms the Unborn Child. You might assume that we could at least agree on that point. But in 21st century America, in post-Roe America, we don't even agree largely on that point. So let's begin there.
Sure thing. I mean, so unfortunately, in 21st century America, there are science deniers. There are people who deny the basic scientific reality that the entity in the womb is an unborn human being. There are also still, in 21st century America, equality deniers, people who deny that all human beings are created equal and endowed by their creator with a right to life. So the more sophisticated pro-choice activists will concede the biological point, right? They don't want to be science deniers. So they'll say, yes, it is an unborn human being, but then they will deny the equality point. And they say, well, but it's not equal to us. It's not yet a moral person. This is the Peter Singer style arguments that you get from, you know, one of the professors at my alma mater at Princeton. They can't affirm the declaration. They don't really believe that all human beings are created equal and endowed by their creator with an inalienable right to life. And that's where we are in 21st century America, right? People either denying the science about the unborn child or the morality, the equality. And what Alexandra and I do in that very first chapter of the book is we just marshal the evidence. We go through the science that shows that it's a human being. We go through the philosophy that demonstrates that it should be treated equal because that unborn human being is our equal. And then we look at the politics of the law, why it's not an overreach of the government to protect the natural right to life of every human being, born and unborn.
Would you like to comment on that as well, Alexandra?
Well, I think Ryan covered it pretty successfully there. But the last point that we do cover in that chapter that I think is important to note is kind of the way in which abortion supporters claim that even if an unborn child is a human person or human being and a human person, somehow a mother's right to her own body or a woman's right to her own body trumps the child's right to life. And this is just the wrong framework, right? We should be thinking about the duties that parents have and a mother has and a father has to care for their children. This is not a competition of rights. And the fact that a child has come into being inside his or her mother is not licensed to kill that child. It's a requirement to care for him.
Interestingly, we have come to accept the notion, and I'm speaking broadly of the culture, that women need abortion to be equal and empowered. And you argue in the book that neither thing has been accomplished. Rather, there has been harm that you outline in detail as a consequent. Talk a bit about that claim that in order for women to be equal to men in our culture and empowered in our culture, she has to have the freedom to destroy the child developing in her in utero, and how that accomplishes exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pervasive claim. I think this is the predominant argument in favor of abortion, and it's so prominent even that the Supreme Court repeated this very idea in its decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, essentially upholding the Roe v. Wade decision. The court said we can't overturn Roe, at least in part because women have come to rely on abortion. Women can't participate in the social or economic life of our nation unless they have abortion as part of helping them order their reproductive lives. And this is a really damaging notion for women for a number of reasons, you know, not least of which is that abortion actually harms women. But the idea of abortion harms women too, right? The notion that there's something dysfunctional or disordered about the female body, about pregnancy, about, you know, the female mode of reproduction. This takes the male body as the norm and as the ideal and treats women as though there's something wrong with them or as though to kind of participate in a man's world, women have to just get rid of whatever the consequences might be of sex and act as though they were never pregnant in order to be able to kind of compete or be on equal footing with men.
We're told that abortion is first and foremost a matter of female autonomy, that it is a benefit to her. And again, in the book, you go in great detail. And I've been in the pro-life movement for decades. This is the best I've ever read on the subject. But you go into detail about the cost and the tremendous message it sends to a woman to suggest that she must fight against, she must reject her own offspring in order to pursue her own interests, and the tremendous toll that takes, certainly on her, but for the broader culture, the father, the broader family, and so on.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that we, and first, thank you for saying that Alexander and I worked hard to try to make this a very clear, compassionate, and persuasive compiling of all of the evidence, all of the arguments. And so it's gratifying to hear you say that about the book. And what we wanted to show is that there's a better way of understanding what women's equality should look like. That what we got for the past 49 and a half years, a version of equality that says in order to be equal, you have to deny your most distinctively feminine attributes, right? The God-given blessing that you can carry a child in your own womb, that to be equal to men, you have to deny that. You have to either sterilize your body or kill your offspring. That's a false vision of equality. And a true vision of equality, it's a colleague of ours at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Erica Bakiaki, who talked about there's an asymmetrical nature to human reproduction, and true equality takes that asymmetry seriously. Rather than trying to force women to live as if defective men, it says the female way of being human is equal to the male way of being human, and we can structure our laws, we can structure our marketplaces, we can structure our education system, including higher education, in ways that take both ways of being human seriously.
One of the things that you argue in the book, post-abortion, that women risk emotional and psychological damage. We're being told in the broader culture that there is no fallout. This is such a benefit. It's such a relief. It opens such a broad set of options for a woman who has chosen to reject her child in favor of her own autonomy, that there is no emotional or psychological damage. And women who dare to speak up are simply denied, first of all, being heard and that they exist.
Yeah, this is a really a damaging aspect, I think, of the pro-abortion rhetoric, right? Because the argument now for abortion is we have to celebrate this. This is a social good. It's not, we don't talk about it as safe, legal, and rare anymore. We're supposed to celebrate abortion and act as though it's always this wonderful solution for women. But the fact is that's actually not most women's experience of abortion. We know from statistics that most women choose abortion because they feel like it's their only option. They're not choosing it because they think it's great or the perfect solution. They're choosing it because they're desperate, essentially, or they're not getting support from the father of the child. They're not getting support from their own family. And we know that after the fact, a lot of women do suffer, like you mentioned, from psychological after effects, whether it's guilt, regret, depression, anxiety, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, even suicide, at elevated rates after having had an abortion. And these women are simply ignored or even attacked when they share their experiences, because we're all supposed to believe that abortion is this wonderful solution.
You also write about the fact that abortion harms the family, the relationship between a mother and a father, the extended family, and so on. Does that make a difference when we're talking about the autonomy of a single woman being able to determine her own future?
Well, yes. I mean, what many women report is that the reason they feel constrained, pressured, unable to carry the child into the world, but forced by circumstances to think that abortion is their least bad option, is precisely because they don't have the support of a marital partner, an extended family. A really stunning statistic is you are a child conceived inside of marriage, you have a 4% chance of dying by abortion. If you are a child conceived outside of marriage, you have a 40% chance of dying by abortion. Another way of putting the statistic is that of all women who seek abortion, only 14% of them are married. By contrast, 86% of women who have abortions are unmarried. Marriage is the best protector of the unborn because what marriage does, it ensures that that man is committed to that woman before children are brought into the world. Anytime you're contemplating an abortion, a child has already been brought into the world. The only question is, will that child be able to exit the womb and enter the visible world to the naked eye? Marriage is the best protector of unborn children. It's also an institution that really helps allow mothers to care for their children and to bring them into the next stage of their lives.
Let me ask you about the decision the Supreme Court made. At the time, as I mentioned, you were writing this book. It wasn't clear which direction the court was going to go. They obviously overturned Roe versus Wade, and there's been a lot of discussion since about what the Constitution actually says about abortion. Those who support abortion rights throughout a pregnancy believe that there is a constitutional right because the Supreme Court said there was. Others who have recognized that there is no constitutional right rejoice that they finally got it right. Your thoughts on the decision that was made by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, sure. So there's nothing.
You can take it, Ryan.
I was going to say there's nothing in the Constitution that even remotely could be construed to protect a right to choose to kill an unborn human being. Whether it was the original Roe v. Wade decision that said it was a privacy right, or then the Casey decision that said it was a liberty right, or then the hope for academic argument was that it was an equality right. This was something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had embraced later in life, and many academic defenders of abortion. So, whether it's privacy, liberty, or equality, all of those rights, those are real rights, but they all have limits. And neither privacy nor liberty nor equality justifies killing another innocent human being. And so our Constitution, rightly understood, has never protected a right to abortion. The Supreme Court simply got it wrong 49 and a half years ago. It repeated the error 30 years ago in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And all the court has done in the Dobbs case is admitted its mistake and overturned Roe and Casey. Now, there are some pro-life scholars, and Alexandra and I are sympathetic to this argument, although we think more research needs to be done, and the current Supreme Court isn't there yet, that argue that rightly understood the 14th Amendment to our Constitution, which prohibits any state from denying equal protection of the law to any person, that should include the unborn human person. I don't think the current court, the votes simply aren't there, which means that in the meantime, we need to pass laws at the state level protecting unborn babies. We need to pass laws at the federal level. We need to work to either have a constitutional amendment or to have justices that interpret the 14th Amendment that way. Because ultimately, we can't be half abortion, half pro-life. In the same way that we couldn't be half slave, half free. As Lincoln taught us, a house divided cannot stand. So eventually, we need to come to a national solution. But we're going to start by doing this state by state, right? We're not there yet, so we need to be making progress at the state level today.
You write in the book, Tearing Us Apart, how the pro-life community can respond to our current situation, and we'll perhaps get into that a bit later, but it's an important part of the book. But let me ask you, the damage that has been done to the medical profession in this nearly 50 years of abortion on demand. Before Roe versus Wade, of course, abortion was legal in some places, including my home state, regrettably, my home state of Oregon and other states. But what has abortion on demand done to the medical profession in terms of perverting its primary purpose and reducing the unborn to something less than worthy of the kind of medical attention that one presumed the oath required preserving?
Yeah, so the problem, of course, with abortion is that it's not actually a healthcare procedure, right? It's a procedure that kills an innocent human being. There are two patients involved in every abortion. There are two human beings there, the mother and the child, and abortion targets one of those human beings for death, and it's not medically necessary. It doesn't cure any disease. It doesn't solve any ailment. It doesn't treat any problem. It just kills a child because a woman doesn't want to be pregnant for whatever reason. And so at that point, once you have a country where this is accepted as a form of healthcare and where some number of doctors are willing to perform this procedure, even though it's not medically necessary, that perverts our understanding of what healthcare is, and it perverts our understanding of what a doctor is. So now, instead of being a medical professional who's using his talents to cure and heal, a doctor becomes essentially a technician for hire who's using the tools of his trade to kill. And so that has very unfortunate downstream effects on all of our medical field.
You know, it's rather interesting. In the book, you offer some examples of medical professionals who practiced abortion, for many, many years before coming to the realization that they are destroying a human body. It's difficult to imagine that you couldn't, that you would be involved in the practice and not recognize that until there's an epiphany at some point. Can you talk a little bit about how some of these medical professionals who have had an about face after having performed abortion for a long period of time, and what the mitigating circumstance is that reverses their perspective on what they have known from a technical and medical standpoint all along?
Sure. I mean, perhaps the most famous example is Bernard Nathanson,
yes,
who was, you know, one of the founders of NARAL Pro-Choice, you know, one of the largest abortion activist groups and abortion providers in the country. And I think Bernard Nathanson himself performed several hundred, if not thousands, abortions. He also oversaw the performing of several thousand abortions in clinics that he oversaw. I don't remember right now what the exact catalyst was in his case. I know one of the other stories that we tell in the book was an abortionist whose daughter tragically,
yes,
died. And then when he returned to work and he's in the middle of performing an abortion, you know, he kind of breaks down. He realizes, I just killed someone else's child. And this was after having spent a couple months off mourning the loss of his own child, which is simply to say that, you know, there's a law written on the heart. People know the truth, especially the abortionists, because, you know, they physically see the unborn child that they, in some instances, are literally tearing apart limb by limb. And then something needs to prick their conscience. It's not enough just to know the facts. There also then, it seems, needs to be something that enlivens them, awakens them, not just to a fact, but also to a value, to a moral norm, to a moral truth. And, you know, sometimes it's a religious conversion. Sometimes the religious conversion comes second, right? They first are converted to the pro-life cause, and then they start asking deeper questions. Well, what is it about life that explains the dignity and the sanctity? And then they arrive at the conclusion of God. But, you know, every individual is unique. And so no two stories are going to be the same.
How has a legal abortion harmed our politics and the rule of law?
Well, there's quite a bit to unpack there. Some of the main points we make in the book, I'll focus on one main one, I guess, is the way that the legalization of abortion has really broken down our political parties, and in particular, the Democratic Party. You know, before Roe was decided, there was such a thing as a pro-life Democrat. A huge number of Democratic politicians consider themselves pro-life, even, you know, voted pro-life. Joe Biden, even right after Roe v. Wade, himself voted in favor of a bill that would have essentially undone what had happened in Roe. And we know kind of where he ended up. So there's been a big change on this in the Democratic Party. And I think we're all worse off because we have one of our two major political parties that embraces abortion on demand for any reason, so much so that, you know, you have Democratic presidential candidates now telling pro-lifers not to vote for them because that's how committed they are to abortion on demand, even though most Democratic voters are not where the party is on this issue at all. Only about 18% of Democratic voters support abortion on demand until birth. And yet the party has fully embraced this this position. And I think we're all worse off because of this. We'd be a much better country if voters had a meaningful choice between two political parties, neither of which was committed to this kind of injustice.
Mm-hmm. One example, in a speech at the NAACP annual convention in Atlanta earlier this month, the vice president compared pro-lifers and the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs to the slave owner of the Old South. She said, our country has a history of claiming ownership over human bodies. Her historical reference was accurate, but the analogy was completely reversed. Again, an example of the misunderstanding of what abortion on demand actually is. She got it exactly wrong.
Yes. I mean, imagine the claim, you know, if you don't like slavery, don't own a slave. Or the claim, I'm personally opposed to slavery, but politically or publicly, I'm in favor of your choice to have a slave. I mean, that's what's at stake when someone says, oh, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I'm, you know, in favor of choice. Or if you don't like abortion, don't have an abortion. The idea that the side in this debate that's in favor of protecting the right to life of the unborn child is actually the analog to the slave owner is just ludicrous. And there have been a variety of academics trying to claim that the 13th Amendment is actually the justification for abortion. And they just seem utterly unwilling to acknowledge that there's already a moral relationship that has taken place. There's already a relationship between that mother and that child. And it's not, you know, involuntary servitude to say that no one, including mothers, can kill their own can kill anyone, right? I mean, it's one thing to say we shouldn't kill strangers. It's another thing to say mothers shouldn't kill their own children.
Given the situation we find ourselves in, I think many folks thought once Roe versus Wade is overturned, our work is done. We recognize now that that is not the case. What should the pro-life movement do next?
Well, we talk about this a bit in our conclusion. Well, at length,
yes,
in our conclusion, and we don't give too many specific prescriptions, but the main thing we call for is, first of all, charity among pro-lifers and prudence as we disagree and discern what the next right steps are, right? Because what's possible in one state is not always going to be possible somewhere else. There are a number of states at this point that have almost total protections for unborn children from the moment of conception. And there are a lot of states where, unfortunately, those laws just aren't politically feasible right now. And so there has to be some kind of room for incrementalism and for understanding that we have to change hearts and minds even as we push for more and more protective laws. So that would be, I think, a major part of the strategy.
I know that you write about pregnancy resource centers. They have been the subject of violence and opposition of late since the early leak of what was likely to be the overturn of Roe versus Wade. What do you say about these pro-life centers that in many cases outnumber abortion clinics across the country and the value that they and the role that they will play moving forward in this post-Roe era?
These pregnancy resource centers are a godsend to thousands of women, women who don't want abortion, women who want to bring their children out of the womb and into the world. And they get no assistance from people who claim to be pro-choice. Right? I mean, I think the attacks that we've seen of pregnancy resource centers really put to lie the claim that the other side is pro-choice. The other side, unfortunately, the activists on the other side, is very much pro-abortion. Right? That's the choice that Planned Parenthood will help you with. They won't actually help you if you're planning to be a parent and you have an unborn child in your womb who you want to bring to term. The pregnancy resource centers do that. And they exist merely to serve those women who voluntarily come to them, seeking their assistance. And that's why it's so utterly grotesque, if not downright satanic, that we've seen the attacks on them over the past several weeks and several months since the opinion was leaked. And I think it's also particularly just unacceptable how unwilling law enforcement has been to go after the people perpetrating these crimes and really, you know, protecting the rights, the freedom, the safety of these pregnancy resource centers to minister to women who are seeking their assistance.
In the book Tearing Us Apart, you make the point that abortion is more than a religious issue. But what would you say to those who argue that it's Christian to support women's right to abortion? We're hearing that a lot from lawmakers, but we might hear it a little closer to home as well.
Well, I find this argument very absurd because it usually comes from the same people who try to claim that being opposed to abortion is just forcing our religion on others. And they're very opposed to that. But then suddenly they also want to have it both ways and argue that supporting abortion is Christian. So there's clearly a double standard here. But more to the point, perhaps it's, of course, not Christian to support killing innocent human beings. Now, it is Christian to support women in difficult circumstances who are dealing with an unplanned pregnancy, who need help and support as they parent or, as they welcome their child. But killing that child is never actually a Christian solution, no matter what situation a woman might be facing. Telling her that it's a solution of some kind to enact violence, lethal violence against her child, is deeply unchristian and deeply wrong.
I like the phrase that you use throughout the book, and to say I like it is a bit odd, but lethal violence, to subject a child to lethal violence, which is a perfect description of what abortion is. One of the points you make is that we don't really talk about abortion. We use euphemisms, but we don't talk about what actually happens. And we try to distance ourselves from that because I think to confront it face on is perhaps too painful for most people. There are some, of course, who might be the exception. How important is it for us to understand precisely what it is we're talking about, what happens in these situations, and whether or not we frame our opinions based on euphemisms or what's actually happening?
Oh, it's vitally important. This is why the other side speaks in euphemism. It's why the other side doesn't actually speak clearly and truthfully about what's going on. It's why the other side right now, as we're speaking, is lying about ectopic pregnancy care, or lying about miscarriage care to claim that pro-life laws would prohibit care in these cases. It's why they use euphemisms like sex-selective abortion rather than, using accurate language. This is a lethal discrimination on the basis of sex. I mean, and it's just so fascinating to me that the voices that are loudest in condemning racial discrimination, sex-based discrimination, disability-based discrimination, they go silent, or even worse, they cheerlead when it's lethal discrimination on the basis of race, lethal discrimination on the basis of sex, lethal discrimination on the basis of disability, which is what we see when we have more Black babies being aborted mm-hmm. than born in New York City. We have millions of missing girls across the globe. We have countries like Iceland claiming to have eradicated Down syndrome, when in reality, they have eradicated people with Down syndrome. They didn't find a cure for the genetic disorder. What they've done is successfully diagnosed and killed all of the children diagnosed with Down syndrome. So it's very important that we don't fall for the euphemism that the other side uses to talk about these issues, that we speak the truth clearly and compassionately.
Well, I appreciate, too, that you go into the history and the founding of the abortion movement, that the eugenicist perspective has been successful even in our century, in that there's a disproportionate number of Hispanic and African American babies who are subject to abortions in this country, an inconvenient truth that again is overlooked or minimized because this is creating opportunity for Black women moving forward.
Yeah, this is a very disturbing argument, and you see in fact in the wake of Roe having been overturned, abortion supporters making the argument that this is disproportionately going to affect non-white populations and women. And my first thought is, well, if that's true, shouldn't we be supporting these women, right? The idea that kind of ramping up abortion numbers or building more abortion facilities in these neighborhoods is not actually a solution. If women of color are feeling like they have to choose abortion at higher rates, then that's a serious problem in our society. And we should be working to support those women, not just kind of helping them access abortion as much as Planned Parenthood would like them to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what can pro-life, and we've touched on this a little bit, but pro-life advocates do to make it easier for women to choose life? We've talked about the pregnancy resource centers, but for the individual, what do you recommend? Because I think when they read the book, they're going to want to be proactive and not just better informed. What can we do to help support women?
There's an endless variety of things that we can do, and it all depends on what our station in life, our vocation in life is. I mean, for some of us, it's going to be prayer. Actually, for all of us, it should be prayer. For many of us, it's going to be a financial contribution. Look up your local pregnancy resource center and start making a monthly contribution. perhaps volunteering your time at that local pregnancy resource center. Perhaps it's becoming a foster parent. Perhaps it's becoming an adoptive parent. Perhaps it's, you know, writing that letter to the editor, writing the op-ed for your local newspaper. Perhaps it's lobbying your state representative. It's going to the state house and speaking with your elected representatives to make sure that they pass the good laws that will be protecting the unborn babies. Maybe it's working on paid family leave or maternity care. I mean, there's a variety of both kind of supply side and demand side public policies that we can be looking at. The supply side being the abortionists, the people who supply the lethal action, the demand. Why do women have a demand? Why do they think they need abortion? There are public policies that can address that as well. So there really is an infinite number of things readers could do after finishing the book. And a lot really just depends on what their station in life and their vocation in life is.
Well, and again, I want to emphasize that at the conclusion of the book, you offer a number of things to think about in terms of how we can contribute to this new landscape post Roe. In a state like Oregon, it's definitely an uphill battle, but one that we've been engaged in for decades and will continue. In other parts of the country, there may be a restriction on abortion that we could only have dreamed of years ago. So there's plenty of work to be done, and it begins, as you pointed out, with prayer and then being willing to move forward in action. I again want to thank both of you for the clearly the hard work that you did in putting this book together. And I would suggest that our listeners get a copy of the book, read it, and purpose to move forward in favor of life. Again, the title is Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. Dr. Ryan T. Anderson and Alexandra DeSantis. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.